Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, welcome to Nature Now for a late August show. The weather seems to be leaning on fall with cool nights, misty mornings, and some welcome afternoon sun, and the deciduous trees are turning khaki. They're losing their fresh spring greens, while Port Townsend prepares for the wooden boat show. Here's our mystery sound. And today we are extremely pleased to have here in the studio Lorna and Daryl Smith, wildlife biologists. They named their business Western Wildlife Outreach, and they educate using accurate, science-based information. They help with the management of large carnivore problems, such as those occurring in stock raising, pasturing, and protecting animal crops. They also share their decades of knowledge by teaching and writing about the behavior of carnivores. So, Daryl and Lorna, I am so glad that you are here. You last came on Nature Now about a year ago and talked about living with bears and cougars. And we thought that today what we would do is step away from that a little bit and talk about what's happening now. What have you been observing, working with? What's different than happened a year ago? We're just sort of leap in here. And one of the things that I noticed, Lorna, maybe you can help me with this. When you describe some of these animals, you say heritage. This is a heritage animal. A lot of times people say that about vegetables, but I haven't heard a lot of people talk about heritage animals. So I'd like to know what brings you to that.
Well, in Washington and actually throughout the West, we have a very rich wildlife heritage, meaning especially these large carnivores, these iconic animals, wolves, bears, cougars, have been on the landscape for millennia. And certainly way before, you know, the white settlers, you know, came to occupy the area. So their wildlife heritage means it belongs to all of us and it's been handed down to us.
So that part of heritage then is a protection aspect.
Yes.
That you're involved in. Okay. So at this point, something is going on with Washington wolf management that you're both involved in and you wanted to bring it up here?
Yes. It's not a good time to be a wolf in Washington, I'm afraid, and it's kind of a long story.
Okay, we got time for a long story, because I'd like our listeners to know what's going on.
So in Washington State, wolves are managed in two ways. They are listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act in the eastern third of Washington, and they are managed under both state and federal ESA Endangered Species Act in the western two-thirds of the state. Where we're having the problems today are in eastern Washington, Colville National Forest area, where the wolves are only listed by the state and managed by the state. The State Department of Fish and Wildlife formed a wolf advisory group made up of ranchers and some conservationists and hunters. They give the department advice on how to approach wolf management. And they came up with recommendations that if wolves prey on livestock, they only have a few chances. And, you know, with a third predation on livestock, they often are put on a, you know, kind of targeted list where the director then can decide he's going to do some lethal control.
Sure. How does the observer know that that is the same wolf the third time?
Well, so this is truly complicated. And one of the things that let me back up just a little bit. So in this area of Washington State, wolves, of course, came in on their own four legs.
Yes.
They have great
they
capacity.
They cross the border.
Move. That's correct. And they've come into one of the most conservative parts of the state. First, because it's closer to the, in numbers, it's closer to the populations in Idaho and Montana and
they
the Rocky
came
Mountain Poly.
Across about where the Okanagan is, thereabouts?
Oh, actually, probably from Spokane northwards, and then we've had some come north from Oregon, probably across the Snake River from Idaho. This area, and national forest lands, many of them, if they're dry enough, are also grazed by ranchers.
And sure, that's true all over the West. Also.
That's correct. Yeah. But one of the biggest issues here is that this is very forested. The cattle range, where almost all these issues occur, is very forested. It is not open range. Cattle can't see each other. Cowboys can't see the cows. So it's excellent wolf habitat. As far as we're concerned, it's as habitat biologists, it is unimaginably poor cattle habitat. The main actor here is the largest probably cattle producer in the state. It's not a little mom and pop operation. Okay. We're talking 7,000 cows. Well, they truck them south to.
It almost seems to me that the issues are not necessarily about the individual, but the context in which the individual is acting.
Yeah, that's correct. So,
and they really want them gone. They really want the
wolves like. Phew.
And as far as we're concerned, and most of us realize, it isn't like a real willful cooperation that we're seeing there too. So as a wildlife biologist, fireworks go up in our minds every time we think about this area.
You know, the lands in question, for the most part, Mary, are public lands in the Colville National Forest. And historically, you know, I mean, recent history, the National Forest lands are, you know, multi-use, and they are leased to cattlemen for grazing. The producers get a heck of a deal with these public lands grazing allotments. They pay $1.39 per cow-calf pair per month to let their cattle graze on our public lands.
Right. My sister, by the way, runs a ranch in Wyoming, and some of this sounds quite familiar. It seems to me that when you think of the word heritage, there are people raising cattle throughout the West who will also say, this is our heritage. Right there, you have the collision of values, I would say, which seems to be what you're saying.
I'm nodding my head to that. You know, there are places where it is totally appropriate to raise cows, and you know, the whole public lands issue is another issue. Mm-hmm. But this is not what people think of as rangeland. If you're a wolf and live in this area, and you see a cow and a calf filter through the woods, just like the moose and the deer and the elk in the area, there is really not a good way for them to figure out what's wild and what isn't.
It looks like lunch no matter what.
Yes, exactly.
Well, and so you have a semi-wild animal, namely the cattle who are managed, versus the wolves who have moved in and are trying to build bigger packs, right? They've lost some packs. I was trying to remember. It seems like somebody counted 18 packs now there aren't. Or how do you figure
that? It's hard, of course, Mary, to count wolves. You know, they don't want to be
counted.
Right, and they're very, very good at staying away from people.
Mm-hmm. But that is the official pack count, 18 in
the
state.
Is it 18?
Yes.
So we have now killed 6 packs for this same ranching organization, but they've refused to take compensation for their animals. And instead, we kill the wolves. That's helicopter time. So it's quite expensive for us. We're taxpayers, and
it's expensive for the wolves too. I mean, I realize that we're sort of treading along a shaky political bridge here, but obviously there has to be an investment by the state of Washington in keeping those packs going.
So, Mary, we see this as a population sink for wolves.
Oh, okay.
When we kill a pack of wolves, a new pack will move in because there's a wonderful rendezvous site in the middle of one of the largest allotments. Uh-huh. And we're talking 50-mile square allotments. And that's just what's happened. That's why we've killed a succession of packs, because kill them and a new pack moves in.
There's a middle step here that we have, you know, maybe neglected to talk about, and that is that our organization, Western Wildlife Outreach, has spent a lot of time, effort, and money on researching and writing advice on non-lethal deterrent measures to keep cattle and wolves apart. As a matter of fact, in 2015, the Department of Fish and Wildlife contracted with Western Wildlife Outreach to do a literature search of all the science papers on this subject and then advise on the best non-lethal deterrent measures that could be employed. And based on those results, then the department came up with a list.
Uh-huh.
And under the protocol, the department has to ascertain that the producer has, in fact, implemented various non-lethal protocol before they will come in and agree to kill wolves. Now, the problem is that the very first thing you're supposed to ask of a producer, you know, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife would help with this analysis is, can you use non-lethal deterrents? Will they work in this situation? Mm-hmm. And we believe that where these wolves have been killed and the cattle and wolves are running into problems, you cannot, for the reasons Daryl listed earlier. Mm-hmm. It's heavily forested, heavily mm-hmm. incised, a lot of down timber on the ground.
People, you can't just run a fence around the place.
No.
I mean, obviously.
So when people think of cattle range land, you can, uh-huh. you think of cowboys on horses and herds of cows.
Still happens.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it still happens. It's not possible here.
In this particular location.
Now, years ago, many, many years ago, we paid to cleanse this area of predators. We used to, when I was a kid, many forest rangers and others, wildlife types, carried a can of cyanide in their pickup truck.
Yeah.
And they salted any dead animal with cyanide. And we had a wholesale kill of all the animals. Yeah.
I've seen pictures of skins tapped into barns where there would be, and the entire side of a barn covered with wolf skin, bear skin, coyote skin.
So this is a big, complicated, not can of worms, it's a mass of worms. And we're hoping that this kind of blunt instrument, which is
shooting
from helicopters, mm-hmm. is going to have a short life.
And as I hear you both talking, this is kind of not solved at this point.
Absolutely not.
Not solved.
There's several lawsuits pending against the state for these actions on the basis that they're not based on science. As a matter of fact, the best available science really points out that lethally controlling wolves and other predators to stop predation on livestock does not work.
And just a short while ago, Lorna, was it last week? What was the lawsuit that was settled?
Well, it wasn't settled, but the plaintiffs in a lawsuit filed in King County against the Department of Fish and Wildlife for moving to kill the Profanity Peak Pack was to get a temporary restraining order against further killing of the pack while this went through the court system.
The difficulty also is that we have a state that seems to be sliced down the middle at the Cascades with views on one side of the Cascades one way and views on the other side. And I was wondering if there is anybody working on the economic value of having wolves. I mean, we know the economic value to the person producing the cattle. That is easy. You can count that. But is there a similar argument for the wolves?
Well, there certainly is a similar argument for the wolf, but I'd like to back up for just a minute to kind of correct one misstatement, and that is that we find a lot of support for wolf recovery in Eastern Washington.
Okay.
The problem is with elected officials, some county commissioners, mm-hmm. the Washington Cattlemen's Association. In fact, most livestock producers in Washington don't belong to these political groups.
Well, you know, what I'm thinking is, as you know, Nature Now prefers not to take a particular political stance. I think that stating that this exists is not going to be particularly a surprise to any of our listeners, but it must affect how the two of you decide to do your work.
We believe that the best way to create a landscape on which large carnivores can live and thrive is mm-hmm. to have an educated public that is willing and informed enough to let them be there.
And the education isn't going to come from a media report of a cougar in the backyard of a school in Quilcene, for instance.
Exactly.
That's not information. That's,
scared tactics.
It's sort of information. But I wondered, as you're working with it, do you get to a certain point where you feel that you've distributed the education that you can, and then with education, you can't sit on someone and say, well, now you've changed your mind. I'm not going to get off until you tell me you have. You can't do that. So it has to be individual choices made throughout Washington State with what we do about predatory carnivores who are heritage animals.
Yes.
So. Yeah. What we've found, and this is what you've certainly found and we've all know about, is that people, when they know something more about something, they just appreciate them much more.
Yes, no matter what you study.
Yes, yeah. Right. For example, with carnivores, you know, we have a whole bunch of ways to relate to people. For example, how many of these folks have carnivores in their homes?
Most of us.
Dogs and cats, right.
Yeah, right.
So carnivores, and you know, it's interesting that that they're our most feared animals, and they're also our biggest friends.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk a lot about safety issues, because that's what people worry about.
Sure.
As an ex-Army Ranger, a combat guy, I have have a probably a little bit different feel for what's safe and what isn't in many ways. And
if you're still standing up at the end of the day, it's been safe. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. We just do our very best to demystify some of these animals. Mm-hmm. For example, cougars.
Yeah, well, I was thinking we might want to switch at this point just briefly to knowing that the question of wolves is ongoing. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest to listeners that they look up your websites and read your material, because it's very clear it gives them a foundation for thinking.
Westernwildlife.org.
Westernwildlife.org.
And we are a nonprofit, and we work with the Woodland Park Zoo, and we work with the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee and the department.
And you're well connected in those ways.
Oh, so we've grown up with the biologists, so we all know each other.
Okay, well, I was thinking let's briefly move to cougars, and then we'll work our way just to the end of what we're doing with this particular edge here. This summer, there has been discussion of cougars along Cape George Road, not too far from where you and I live.
We've seen them there.
I know. They also have apparently been living pretty heavily in Quilcene and Brennan. Is this unusual, or are we just getting more coverage? Is the media more awake?
We get waves of interest in cougars. So we have a good population of cougars in Washington State. We've always had them here. If you see deer, you look out your window, and you don't live in the middle of Port Townsend, you see deer, then there are cougars in the region. And we have good numbers of cougars.
And also part of the more interest in cougars, Department of Fish and Wildlife issued a directive to their field staff, to the enforcement people, that rather than take a chance, as it was worded, let a cougar, you know, go, maybe relocate it or something, they are just moving to kill cougars when somebody complains. So there's been more cougars killed, quite a few more this year.
This year, and it's noticeable, and nobody in the newspaper ever writes, everything's fine with local cougars, go home, there's nothing going on. But maybe it's an accident that
cougars
it's...
Cougars are being killed for going after chickens. So these are wild animals. You know, the danger is, there's always danger with any of these animals. They're large, powerful. There have been 2 people killed ever in cougars. By cougars in Washington
State. In total
State.
History,
in,
right?
In our history.
Yeah.
There are enough cougars around that they could get 20 of us a day if cougars really were after people.
We won't quote you on that.
No.
You can.
No, you can. That's one of the things I say. So we have to keep our eye on it, but we don't want to move to hysteria. And most people are good around here with that.
I think so, too. But I had just noticed that it seemed to be a crowded summer. I live very close to Blue Sky in that region. Mm-hmm. I guess people were finding them walking through the backyard. There's a lot of woods around here, and there are a lot of places for cougars to hide.
And a lot of deer.
So I've shown community groups. I've shown overheads, maps and so forth, showing travel corridors, coyotes and cougars, and everybody use them. If you live close to the beach, cougars use the beach at night, and so do deer.
Right.
And also that slope, that's too slopey for people to walk on.
Right, but if you have the right kind of feet, it's just fine.
Right kind of feet.
Well.
And you're looking for food?
Well, I was thinking just briefly so we can get this in. Cougars are legitimate to hunt, yes?
Yes.
Is that true? Is that true of bears also?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, so primarily, and one of the issues, and I've been a hunter.
I have no problems with hunting at all, but I just wondered if that was part of the cougar problem.
Well, there's been lots of science on this, actually. And we know that the older the population of cougars is, the fewer the problems you have with them.
Older cougars
didn't get to be older because they cause problems.
Right.
And the other point is that not only are the older cougars smarter, but they keep the younger cougars away from areas where, you know.
Younger males especially, you know, the older males will keep the younger males away. And many of the cougars that we see are younger animals trying to find a place to live. And if you have rabbits, and when they're younger, we know that they eat smaller prey. So they eat rabbits.
I have a good supply of rabbits right off of Cape George Road. And
raccoons.
I'm looking at them going, lunch, whoa.
That's right.
I think that as long as the people listening to us will go to your handouts or your writing and learn a little more about this before the next thing appears in the paper. That's going to help.
That's good advice.
Okay. I am very thankful that you have been here, and we are right at the end of our time. So I wanted to say both thank you, and you will be back on the air on the 4th of September, and we'll carry on with some of the things that we're working on. We always have a mystery animal, and today it's the coyote. Everybody knows what they sound like, but is there a season when we're more likely to hear them? I have not been hearing them. I hear them in the spring, but I don't seem to hear them now.
You know, so where we live in Cape George, we probably have two family groups that are on both sides of Cape George, and I hear them most of the time. Most nights, in fact, I have recordings. I get up, and if I hear them, I record them. So they're active year-round. But later,
and day and night also.
Day and night, oh yes. And most animals are actually on 4 hours, off 4 hours, unless they're really strictly trying to avoid people.
There is one point I want to make about coyote sounds, and that is we hear from people a lot when, they'll say, oh, there must have been 10 or 12 coyotes, and they must have been tearing up some,
some helpless animal.
Yeah. But in fact, that sound is probably...
So it's just, these are family groups. Mm-hmm. Packs of coyotes are family groups. They hunt singly, and every little bit, the adults will howl, mm-hmm. and where is everybody, right?
And everybody chips in.
Yeah, everybody chips in. And
it's like that movie about the Dalmatians where the sound starts just moves itself, right?
So that cacophony is often when the parent has brought back food to the pups and they're just so excited about it.
Yeah, so and we've actually watched coyotes do this for some time. Fascinating, fascinating animals.
Well, I think that people tend to be gnashing their teeth partly because of concern about the coyotes grabbing something they don't want to have gone.
We tell people not to feed them their cats. Yeah. Don't feed them cats. That means keep them in the house.
Exactly. Yep. So thank you. Now, for those of you who are thinking about this mystery animal, let it find its own food and not the food you don't want them to get. And all of these predators that you have worked with and studied are bright or they wouldn't live.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Right? They're absolutely all fascinating.
They're all working neurologically. Yeah. Smart.
Yep, so, big brains.
Okay. Thank you. I have really enjoyed this, and we'll look forward to hearing from you on the 4th of September.
Thanks, Barry. Okay.
Thank you very much, Mary.
Sure. We have a couple of observations after all of the great information we got from Daryl and Lorna Smith. But here's a fall observation. I have started to notice strands of spider web across paths in woods and bushes, even on the front porch. They are also waterproof. Some people consider fall to be spider time, but we have spiders all year. The most obvious traps which the fall spiders make are the artistic and fascinating orb webs. These webs appear in fall because the spiders that build them have grown to adults from their spring hatching.
The Pacific banana slug is a majestic mollusk. Gardeners are often plagued by imported European slugs smaller than the banana slug. The Pacific banana slug is not a pest. It can grow up to 9 inches long and may not be yellow. The yellow with occasional black blotches gives it the common name. Native to moist coastal forests of the Pacific, the banana slug contributes to the forest health by eating old dead leaves and undergrowth. The most common danger to the banana slug is drying. In dry weather, they can estivate, pulling themselves down into soil and reducing their movement. Estivation also helps with their winter survival. Their mucus helps them move and keep their outer skin moist. Their mucus contains a chemical that numbs the mouth of a predator, such as a raccoon. Okay. Now on to events.
Okay. Events. The Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society, bringing us another opportunity to learn, they are having a day of studying at Nea Bay. The date is Sunday, August 25th, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The leader is John Gashett, and what you do is meet the group in Nia Bay at Washburn's store on Highway 112. John Gashett will answer your questions, and his number is 503-781-5043. Thank you for joining us on Nature Now today. Alex Henley engineered and spoke, and we hope you enjoyed this eclectic report on local natural happenings and big animals. Nature Now airs Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 5:05, and Saturdays at 12:30. Or follow us on www.kptz.org.